And now we turn from the nitty-gritty of trade execution to the construction of portfolios with Cameron Height. Cameron, thanks for joining me. Thanks for coming by.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Ted.
Why don't we start with your background and how you got to founding Alpha Theory?
I graduated from UNC Chapel Hill, and then I moved up to New York, where I was an equity analyst for CIBC, then DLJ, and then Lehman Brothers. So I was on the equity side during the heyday of the dot-com boom. I then was hired away by one of the funds that I was a client of. There I became an equity analyst for a hedge fund, long-short equity fund. That led me to find the problems that Alpha Theory tries to solve.
And what are those problems?
Well, I think it's something that is not just specific to investing. I think it's something that's specific to all forms of decision making, is that we take things that are generally implicit and we use them to make decisions when we're better off taking things that are implicit, making them explicit, using those explicit assumptions with a set of rules to make better decisions. And so
let me dive in just a little bit there. So what's implicit and what's explicit in that definition?
Yeah, so let me give you an example for investors. So imagine I'm an analyst walking to my portfolio manager's office, and we're talking about investing in a security, and I believe that I tell him, you know, I think this stock has a lot of upside, it's got a great management team, not a lot of downside, it's kind of illiquid, so we have to be aware of that. You know, hey, portfolio manager, try and size that position. There's a lot of implicit information that I've given him. And so if I could translate implicit information into explicit assumptions, then we can be better off. So if I, instead of saying I have a lot of upside, I'd say I have 60% of upside. Or I say I don't have a lot of downside. I say 20% of downside, because my portfolio manager could have interpreted a lot of upside as 120% or 30%. There's a great quote by Richard Schuer, who wrote The Psychology of Intelligence Analysis, where he says that objectivity is gained by making assumptions explicit so that they can be examined and challenged. It's one of my favorite quotes, because it is the essence of what we try and do. We try and help firms take a lot of the bias and emotion of the decision-making process out so that they can make better decisions.
And what are the mistakes that you see portfolio managers make?
Step one is really that sort of implicit, explicit translation. Then setting rules around those things. So if I set rules for how I want to size a position, how I want to think about liquidity, how I want to think about risk reward, I need them to be explicit so that I can actually follow them. But even if they are explicit, what we find is a lot of times people override the rules that they've set in advance. And I think that there's enough cognitive science studies, psychological studies that show that experts really aren't good at making decisions in general. Political pundits on who's going to be elected, or wine experts on what's a great vintage, or an oncologist on who is most likely to get cancer. And so these are people that are experts that spent their whole life studying these things. And so as an example, let's say the oncologist study. The oncologist were asked to tell the psychologist, what's important to you when you try to determine how long someone's going to live with cancer? And they will say, you know what I care about? I care about, you know, if I'm looking at the x-ray, I want to see the tumor, the perimeter, how far it's spread, its size, the age of the patient, T-cell count. And I'm not a doctor, so I can't give you the litany of things that they care about. But they're going to give you this litany of things that they care about. And what the psychologists do is they go off to the side and they take all of the attributes that the oncologist said were really important, and they come up with a simple algorithm that weights them all equally and says, okay, we're going to forecast how long someone's going to live based on the criterion that was set up by the oncologist themselves. And then they have the oncologist, just using the information they said was important, also forecast how long that person's going to live. And guess what? The little algorithm that the psychologist built over to the side wins every time. They've done hundreds, maybe even thousands of these studies now. And the little simple algorithm wins every time. So, you know, one of the biggest mistakes that we find is that people like to use their mental calculator to make decisions, when ultimately the little simple model that they built is far superior to what they've done in their head.
Right. So when you take that framework and apply it to portfolio construction, what is the tool that Alpha Theory is providing to portfolio managers?
Largely what we're doing is we're a toolkit. We're trying to allow portfolio managers to do what they're doing already, but trying to take those implicit assumptions, we capture a lot of those implicit assumptions and allow them to make them explicit inside of our system. So those things can be something as simple as how much do I believe I can make if I'm right, how much I could lose if I'm wrong, what are the probabilities of those things occurring. And I think that your last couple of podcasts, you had Mobison on, you had Andy Duke on. One of the things that they found of paramount importance and they kept coming back to was expected value, or coming up with ways of using probabilistic expectations to come up with the decisions that people should make. And so what we do is we want to capture that and make the implicit explicit, and then allow them to find other things that they deem important. It can be a checklist of items. So how good is the management, more than the rate, how good the management team is, or how good is the balance sheet? And for each of our clients, it's different. But taking those implicit assumptions, making them explicit, and then allowing a portfolio manager to set rules for how they want to translate explicit information into decisions. That decision inside of a portfolio is going to be, what's a position size? A 0% position size is still a decision. It's deciding not to do something. But taking assumptions that are implicit, making them explicit inside of our system, setting rules, and then allowing those rules to dictate how we size positions in a portfolio. You point out where there's discrepancies between what you said you wanted to do a priori and what you're actually doing. And those incongruous situations are the ones where you either have to, as a portfolio manager, say, yep, I need to trade, or I need to reassess my assumptions.
What have you found changes in the sort of portfolio manager's implementation once they're using alpha theory compared to when they aren't?
It runs a gamut. So we will walk into a new fund that we start working with, and they already have a lot of this philosophy embedded in their mentality. So codifying that is relatively straightforward. Then we'll have others where a lot of this is greenfield for them. And so we're asking questions that as a firm, they know they should have been asking, but they haven't been. And so a lot of it is the big gains that they get from starting to use alpha theory is the initial phase where they try and come up with a similar vernacular and standardization for how they make decisions. And a lot of those questions are really enlightening for them. And so for both firms, once they get to the point where they have a process in place, it starts to become refinement over time. There's an evolution. Just like I said before, people like to override the system. Because we have empirical evidence that proves out if it works or not, we can then get them more comfortable with making decisions using the model they built in advance instead of overriding it.
And how do you find people balance that? You've put a system in place and it's based on explicit assumptions, but even the forecasts, the assumptions aren't going to be that precise. So there's this balance between, okay, we're going to stick with the model and, oh no, we're still going to override it because our intuition is telling us that something's off with the model.
That's probably one of the biggest challenges, that people realize that the inputs into the system are just good guesses, and sometimes they're not even good. What we're doing is we're saying, hey, take this information that you know isn't quite right and use it to make decisions. Well, that's a hard thing to, on paper, look at and say, I'm going to do that. But let's recognize, let's look at the counterfactual. What are we doing already? As a portfolio manager without the system, we're doing the exact same thing. We're already taking that information in and we're processing it mentally, and it's implicit. And we believe that our mental calculator is better at taking those ambiguities and refining them so that they come up with better results. But really, honestly, we're not. Let's recognize this is a garbage in, garbage out system either way. If garbage goes into alpha theory in our case, or goes into the portfolio manager's head in the heuristic kind of case, either way, it's garbage in. And so I believe that what happens is by making things explicit, you can objectively analyze and challenge the assumptions that you're making. Because, you know, if I come in and I say it's got a lot of upside, you know, it's a lot different than saying it's 8 times 2018 EBITDA of $500 million. We clearly recognize that, and most fund managers are already doing that. I think one of the great things that Mobison always talks about is the outside view. Then what you want to do is then take some of that and, you know, compare that to what's the historical highest multiple this thing has ever traded at, and what is the industry trading at, and have this outside view to really give a portfolio manager a way of sort of creating a foundation for how they're making those decisions.
And as portfolio managers implement this, what have you found? You've been doing this for 10 years, so what have you found in terms of outcomes?
Overall, what we found is that just like in the expert studies, people would have done better off if they had followed the model that they built. And it works out about 75% of the time that clients would have been better off if they would have followed the model they built instead of what they actually did.
So that's once they hired you and they're using the model, they're still not quite following.
Yeah, we have correlation statistics that actually show the correlation between the model that they built, we call it optimal position size, and what they actually do. And the discrepancies can be different for different clients. Some of them are very highly correlated, you know, 98%, and then others are have wide gaps. What we found over time is that, number one, our clients in general outperform others. So we only have 6 years worth of data, but going back—
And that universe is long short equity?
It's primarily 86% of our clients are long short equity.
And that and U.S. focused or not necessarily?
We have a few Hong Kong, few London, few Canadian. But what we found is that our clients over the past 6 years, which is as far back as we have data, have outperformed the Equity Hedge Index every single one of those years. There's a, either it's part of that's alpha theory, I'd like to believe that, but part of it is just they're process oriented to begin with. And I believe that people that are process oriented generally outperform. But then for each of those 6 years, our clients would have done better each of those 6 years if they would have followed the model that they built. With consistency. Every single year. Every single year they would have done better. And so there's a huge gap. I mean, let's recognize, I keep going back to Mobison, but he's talking about paradox of skill. And so there's a lot of really smart people out there looking at the same thing. So finding really good ideas is incredibly challenging right now. The edge that we find a lot of time actually needs to come from better position sizing and not from better stock selection, because stock selection is so hard. It's just maximizing the value that you can capture from the research that you perform.
I was always astounded. We met a long time ago, and I remember looking at alpha theory pretty early on. I was always astounded how simple the tool was. And you could look at it and say, well, I should be able to do this on my own. And yet, yeah. To your point, like, people don't.
I remember when I was explaining to my family for the first time, like, I was leaving the hedge fund that I was working for, and I was going to start alpha theory. I was trying to explain to everyone what I was doing. And my grandmother said to me, "You mean they're not doing this already?" And it's...
Your grandmother?
Yeah, my grandmother. It's like... And it's really hard to disabuse people of the fact that very smart people that are making millions and some of them billions of dollars a year have these huge gaps in their decision-making process. But it's not uncommon. I mean, look at sports and Moneyball. Moneyball's been around, I don't know how long, 25? I don't know. You probably know better than I. How long it's been around?
It's not that old. Yeah. I'm not sure. I'd have to look it up.
Well, I'm just talking about when Billy Beane started implementing it at Sabermetrics and Billy Beane implementing it at the A's. The gaps still persist in baseball. Not everyone has adopted these empirically proven rules that make us make better decisions. Football is still coming along, and hockey and soccer, all of the sports where it should have changed. Michael Lewis has a great quote where he talks about the ossification of industries, where things that have been going along for decades and sometimes centuries, like baseball, there's a dogma that gets created, and people assume that the dogma is correct because everybody believes it. And so it's challenging that dogma. And the dogma for our world is that portfolio managers are these savants that can consume large amounts of information and translate it into great decisions that no one else can do. And there may be people that are, and I'm not questioning that, but I don't think that the large majority of us are. I think what we're generally good at, and people that are in this profession have grown up being great analysts. We're really good at finding good stocks and digging in and finding out their economic value and what's their potential risks on the downside and how good is the management. That's what we're really good at. Translating that information into a portfolio, I don't think we really have a lot of skills there. So let's use computers and let's use rule sets to help us do a better job.
This notion of disaggregating the security analysis from portfolio construction is one that, you know, comes up, and you can look at it on the long-only world. You have certain high active share managers that may only have 10 or 15 stocks, and then you have the sort of index-hugging mutual funds of old that have low tracking error. And one is really about stock selection, one's about portfolio construction. On the hedge fund side, you have the long-short equity fund that's the one you described that's focused on analysis. And then you have kind of the platform firms, the Millennium, the old SAC, or .72 now, that were really focused more on risk management and portfolio construction. In your work with a variety of different clients, have you seen sort of differences in a certain manager or firm is a great analytical firm in picking stocks? Another one may or may not be that great at picking stocks, but makes up for it in their skill in portfolio construction.
I'll have to say that my perspective is limited. So I don't have a lot of experience working with, let's say, a macro manager, which, you know, those are the folks that are generally associated with being really great traders, like a Paul Tudor Jones. Or there could be a lot of that. What I typically end up, the people that are attracted to what we're doing are the people that are, you know, have a scientific mindset. They end up being those that have the fundamental background and come out of that analyst mold and are trying to be better portfolio managers. So I wish I had a great perspective there. I don't know that I have seen anyone that I could empirically prove that they're just really great position sizers, or they're really good at overriding the system. Maybe that's a better way of saying it. I don't think I've found that yet. Remember, there's a selection bias in our clients. What we have found, though, is that we can find people that are really good stock pickers. And we can measure that in a few different ways. You can do it based on their forecast for where they believe the stock's going to go. And I'm measuring what actually happens in the future. We have that kind of data because we have 135,000 price target forecasts across our history to be able to analyze how good are analysts. And so we can actually tease some of that out using Breyer scores to using some of the stuff that we learned after reading Phil Tetlock's Super Forecasting. What makes or what is a good stock picker? We also can sort of just say, is the portfolio manager good at figuring out the assets in his portfolio, his or her portfolio, that are most likely to outperform? And the way that we measure that is something simple as saying, we take the top 10 positions compared to 10 through 20, 20 through 30, and just say, is the batting average higher for the top 10 versus the next 10 versus the next 10? If we take their forecast and say, is the highest expected returns, do those outperform, those top 10s outperform the next 10, outperform the next 10? And what we can find, we can sort of point to the managers that have that skill. It's been enlightening, and we can reflect back to our clients where they can make improvements in their process, because we can point out things like, on average, your upsides are too aggressive, but your downsides are about in line. And overall, your probabilities, for instance, our clients on average assume that they'll make money 74% of the time. That's basically, they forecast an array of scenarios, and we can pick the scenarios that are forecasted to make money, and we just add up the probabilities associated with those scenarios. On average, our clients assume they're going to be right 74% of the time. But guess what? They're only right 51% of the time. So there's a big gap, and we can point out those gaps. We call it probability inflation. And what our clients are able to do is to rectify that the next go-round. The next time they're making forecasts, they can come up with more conservative probability assessments, which ends up creating portfolios which are skewed less towards risky assets. And so these are good things that you can get from empirical evidence. And, you know, it goes along with feedback mechanisms that make great athletes. You can't be a great athlete without great feedback. You know, it's kind of the 10,000 hours thing. We're giving them feedback to help them hone their skill, be it price target forecasting, being probability forecasting, being position sizing, and understanding the inputs of their process that actually matter to them.
Now, one of the things that you just mentioned was that if people have a bias towards being right in their probability assessment and can adjust that, they'd have a less risky portfolio. You've also written a piece called The Concentration Manifesto that almost argues for the opposite of that in some sense, depending on how you define risk in the portfolio. So why don't you talk about what your research has shown you and what the Concentration Manifesto is all about.
Yeah, so at a high level, what the Concentration Manifesto is that active management is under immense pressure, and a big part of that is self-induced because either fees are too high to get over the hurdle of the performance that they generate. And, you know, they do generate alpha. It's just the alpha's not high enough to get over the fees. it's also self-induced because we've been told by the people giving us money, either an institutional allocator or retail allocator, that we need to be diversified. We need to control risk as a portfolio manager. But once again, it goes back to what I was saying before. We're trained to be great analysts, and generally we can pick good stocks. So what we've found, going back to that example that I gave before, is that if you look at a fund's top 10 positions, those, for our clients at least, and a lot of other academic studies, I know that Novus did some research here as well, the top 10 positions outperform the next 10, outperform the next 10. And so for our clients, it ended up being, you know, I said the batting average for our clients was right around 51%. This is on an alpha adjusted basis. So the top 10 positions was 57%, next 10 was 55, next 10 was 52, and then it went into, right after 30, it sort of went into randomness. Basically, it was a coin flip if you were picking a good stock or not. And so my premise is this. If we as active managers want to survive, we need to do what we're good at, which is picking good stocks and not diluting ourselves with portfolios of 100 plus stocks. If we can pick 30 good positions, 30 may not be the, it's no magic number here. It's going to be different for different folks, but just to say 30. And then we can generate alpha that way. Yes, there are risks inherent in creating a portfolio of 30 stocks, but typically our clientele is not investing in just our fund. The risk mitigation that they may, that we may have wanted to create, they can create themselves by investing in multiple different funds with different attributes. And so what I would get is if I'm an, let's say I'm an institutional investor, and I basically have an array of funds right now that are generating 51% batting averages, and then I could just say, nope, all of you guys go to your 30 best positions, and all of a sudden the batting average goes to 57% across all of them. I don't dilute that batting average for any of them. I still get a 57% batting average, but I can create the diversification effect by investing in multiple different managers. So it's a beautiful concept. Here's the challenge, though, is that there's business risk for the hedge fund manager that takes on this strategy because they inherently could have taken on bigger positions. They have a higher likelihood of losing more money. And dogma, which we were talking about before, for the allocator is that that's not typically what we do. We invest in people that are thinking about risk. And so a lot of, there needs to be a conversation between managers and allocators to get on the same page so that this kind of evolution in our industry can happen. It's better for the managers, it's better for the allocators, and it will be the kind of thing that can save active managers.
I just want to be clear about this 51%. I want to make sure I understand this. So when you're talking about a batting average, what is the math behind that calculation?
Yeah, it's super simple. We take, let's say you have 100 positions. How many of them made money net of the benchmark? How many of them lost money net of the benchmark? And so 51 out of the 100 positions in our average client.
And that's both the long side and the short side.
Yeah, we look at it both ways. Okay. It doesn't end up mattering too much. We actually came up with this concept of size-weighted batting. And it's very similar to the AUM-based performance, alpha generation, so which showed that active managers were able to contribute more net alpha. If you don't look at an average, you look at it on a size-weighted basis. This is something that we also found across our clients, is that batting average, when we just take and multiply, basically we're just summing up the total exposure that made money versus the total exposure that lost money, it actually goes to 54.4% from 51%. And what that basically is saying is, going back to the concentration manifesto, there's a lot of little small positions that they're losing money on that they shouldn't have in their portfolio in the first place.
Are your clients, you mentioned 86%, is that primarily long short equity managers? And what's in the other 14%? And where else could you apply this tool?
So long only managers. It's just that our background is, I came out of a hedge fund. A lot of my friends worked for hedge funds. And so our initial sort of clientele were those folks. And it's a network effect. They tell other people, and they happen to be hedge fund managers. But I actually think that this is what we're doing a lot of times is more applicable to a long only manager, because they end up having a larger stable of analysts working for them. And they have less of a conversation sometimes between that. Just imagine Neuberger, for example, they have a large number of analysts, and they have portfolio managers that don't directly control those analysts, unlike a hedge fund. And so the information flow and making things explicit is so much more important in that process. And they end up having a lot more rules as well. And so there's a good fit for that. It's just haven't had as many conversations with mutual fund managers.
Have you had any conversations with credit managers and distressed debt managers?
Yeah, I mean, this is decision-making 101. It's what we're doing. You could apply to trying to buy a house or, you know, should I take a new job? This is all applicable. And yes, we have had some high-yield distressed guys that have said this is something that we're working with a few right now to vet that idea. But it's the same. You're still coming up with, you know, the upside may be par instead of something. Actually, in some ways, it's better because your expectations are a lot more discreet. You know, you kind of know what your upside is. You kind of know what your downside is. And the probabilities are still a little fuzzy, but, you know, the assumptions going in are a lot better.
If you turn the table a little bit and think of this from an allocator's perspective, what questions should allocators be asking of managers they're interviewing that would indicate whether they're sort of navigating this well or not?
You were an allocator for a long time, and you asked a lot of these questions. And the question is, how do you size positions? Every allocator asks that question. And portfolio managers are well trained to say that what we do is we're constantly looking at risk reward. We're evaluating that. We're making sure that our best ideas are our biggest positions. We want to evaluate management teams and constantly looking at risk and other portfolio factors and trying to make sure that we're not in too crowded of bets and looking at exposure analysis. And they just, when you walk through it that way, it sounds great, but how do you do it? And really the question that an allocator could ask is say, hey, what's your sixth best idea? And pause and wait for them to tell you what their sixth best idea is. Now, if they can turn to a sheet or a dashboard or something like that that says, that's my sixth best idea, adjusted for all the things that I care about, which are going to be risk reward, drawdown risk, liquidity, all those kinds of things, I can look down my list and say, this is my sixth best idea right now because things change. If they can tell you that, they can manage their portfolio effectively because they can make sure that their best ideas are their biggest positions, their 16th best ideas, their 16th largest position. But if they can't quickly tell you, they don't have somewhere to turn, and if they can't answer that question in 5 minutes, there's a hole in their process.
How much does the optimization of the inputs of the tool reacting to the just dynamism of markets or stock price movements end up driving kind of the efficiency of portfolio construction? So you have your assumptions. The assumptions might not change, but stock prices are moving and managers trade around a little bit every day. And the question is, are they making the right trades?
We find managers should be trading around positions more. They're generally not. And the positions that's easiest to ignore is the one that's working and making you money. And so what happens in that situation is the price is going up, which means the position size is going up as a percentage of your total assets under management. And so let's say a 5% position has now grown to a 7% position. But what also happens to the expected return in that case? The expected return goes the opposite direction, all else being equal. Let's just say that our price target was 100, the stock's gone from 50 to 70. So the expected upside has gone down, the expected downside has gone up, and clearly something's changed. Maybe the probabilities of upside or downside, but clearly you can reset those expectations. But the expected return in some ways has gone down while our position size is going up. Managers in general should be trading more because there's a big reversion to the mean factor in the market.
Yeah, it's a tricky one because it's easy to embrace the notion that trading creates transactions costs and therefore people should trade less. And this is just movement around stock prices on a path. What other research have you been able to do based on the data that you're receiving from doing this a long time? And what has that shown you?
One of the things that we did is we wanted to see if our clients that used our system more frequently were better performers. One of the simple things that we did was just say, all right, let's carve out the positions of all of our clients and put them into two buckets. One bucket's going to be positions where they took the time to come up with a price target. The other bucket's going to be positions they didn't take the time to come up with a price target. Well, guess what? The ones with price targets outperform the ones without price targets. And it was a huge margin. Basically, 7% was the return on invested capital for positions with price targets. 1% was the return on invested capital for positions without price targets.
And again, those are alpha percentages?
No, it's just pure return on invested capital. Yeah. It's such a simple rule that a firm can implement where we have enough data that should say, if you don't take the time to put in a price target, don't put the position on. Then we went to and said, okay, well, let's think about that a little bit further. We have a little bit of other data for our clients where we can break them down into the people, like I mentioned before, most correlated. So how closely do they follow the model? What's the percentage of coverage of price targets in their portfolio? And how fresh are those price targets? So if they haven't updated in 90 days, it starts to get to the point where we call it stale. What percentage of their portfolio has been updated in the last 90 days? So we take those three metrics: correlation, coverage, and freshness. And we scored them equally and quartiled our clients and said the best actors, second best actors, third, and worst. And then we just did return on invested capital for each of those. And it was, I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but it's going to be directionally accurate. The top was around 9% return on invested capital. The second was like 7%. The next was like 3%. The bottom was like 0%. And there is a distinct correlation, at least in our small sample size. Once again, keeping in mind a small sample size, a distinct correlation between process and performance.
What's been the biggest challenge in running this business?
Changing human behavior. I don't think that we go into too many meetings where people sit across the table from us and they say, this thing that you're proposing that we do is a bad idea and not something we should do. Almost uniformly, they all agree that this is something that they should probably do, with Alpha Theory or not. They should definitely create some more process around how they make decisions in general. But I sort of equate it to a gym membership. Everyone knows that going to the gym or working out or whatever way you want to analogize it, it is important to our health and our well-being and our happiness and all of these things. And we have three different groups of people. There's the people that say, yep, that's a great point. I'm going to sign up for your gym. And they're going to go. Great. Those are the people we're looking for. Then there's going to be the other people that are aspirational. And they're going to say, yeah, it's a great idea. I'm going to sign up for your gym. And they go. They try it out. Doesn't quite stick. It's behavior. They stop going and they cancel their membership. And then there's the third group of people that just know up front, I'm not going to do this. And even though they know they should, they still don't. Most of us overeat at Thanksgiving and Christmas. Why is that? We know we shouldn't, but we still do it. We're humans. And so I think that's probably the biggest challenge. I think I went into this a bit Pollyannish, understanding, and my belief was that you build it, they will come, because it is a concept when said out loud. It is, yeah, duh, we should do that. But that's not the way humans work. I think that I was speaking at a conference a few months ago, and Daniel Kahneman was a keynote, and somebody asked a question about him and his career. And he said, it actually took like a cynical turn, because he said one of his biggest disappointments is that all of these cognitive biases that he has exposed with and others have exposed over the years, they really haven't made that much of a difference. And his point was that just knowing about a bias doesn't change human behavior. That's what we're doing in a lot of ways, is just trying to iron out the noise, help firms put process into place to help them make the decisions they said they wanted to make in the first place.
All right, Cameron, time for some closing questions. What is your favorite sports moment?
Favorite sports moment. I am so glad that you asked. I'm a huge Carolina basketball fan. I went to...
Wearing Carolina blue today.
Yes, I am. I normally wear my Carolina belt. I didn't today. We play Duke tomorrow. I grew up 30 minutes from Chapel Hill, went to school there. And I remember probably two different times. 93, when we won the national championship, I was in my mom's den with a bunch of my buddies from high school. And we drove up to Chapel Hill, went to Franklin Street and celebrated. That's probably, hands down my favorite sports memory. But I was in Phoenix last year for the win over Gonzaga, which was being there and actually see it happen was pretty stellar too.
What teaching from your parents has most stayed with you?
I have two amazing parents. They are both very happy And I don't think that it's anything necessarily that they taught me through verbalization, but it's more through following their lead. They're both selfless people, and they put others first. You know, you don't really know how that leads to happiness, but I clearly have seen that in them, that putting others first makes them happy. And I try and be, quote unquote, a nice guy. And a big part of that is what I've seen and experienced from my parents.
What information do you read that you get a lot out of that other people might not know about?
I mean, I knew this question was coming, and I couldn't even think of anything. And the funny thing is, I'm a follower when it comes to information. And there's a Tim Ferriss, I think it's Tim Ferriss, where he talks about you have a rule of three before you read a book. You hear it from three different people that you trust before you read a book. And that's kind of the way that I do everything. And I do read a broad array of things. And so it's not specific information from one place, but I'll read about physics or historical fiction or just a history book or about AI or, you know, a ton of cognitive science books, investing books, business books. And so I try and have a wide array, a Renaissance kind of mindset. I'd say that's probably the most important thing that I have from a learning standpoint, from an information standpoint, but I wish I had some great source, but I don't.
What lesson have you learned that you wish you knew a lot earlier in your life?
We're type A people, and we go a million miles a minute, and we have no spare time. It's to try and slow down and enjoy more. Yeah. I have an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old, and so when people that are older than me tell me that it goes by so fast. I mean, I can't tell you. Every parent has had 100 different people say, enjoy every minute you can. It goes by so fast. And when you're living in the moment, you can't appreciate that. You really just can't. And so what I try and do is honor their opinions, because when you hear it so many times from people that have been there, you have to take it at face value and believe that it's an objective fact, sort of a tangent. But it kind of reminds me of people always say that as I get older, time just seems to fly. And I think it's an effect of our denominators growing. I remember when I was 5 years old, a year seemed like forever, you know, because it's 1/5 of my life. Now I'm 40. A year, I can't believe how fast 2017 went by. It's 1/40th of my life. So there's a denominator effect, which changes our perspective.
All right. It's your waning years. Active managers now rule the roost because they've all been using Alpha Theory. You're sitting back in your rocking chair. What advice would you give yourself today?
It'd be a lot of the same. I think it'd be slow down. I think that what I found is that as I've had kids and as I have gotten really busy with Alpha Theory, I've lost touch with a lot of the friends that I hold dear. And I think that I will look back as a person sitting in my rocking chair and say to myself, did you make a mistake there? You need to honor those relationships and put the time. I mean, every relationship requires an investment. Marriage, your kids, your friends, your family. And have you invested enough in that? Because those are the things that really pay dividends when you're sitting in that rocking chair.
Cameron, thanks so much.
Thanks, Ted. Appreciate it.
Hey, before you take off, I've started sending out a monthly email that shares a small selection of what caught my eye over the month. I get a lot of emails like this, and I'm sure you do too, so I'm only going to send no more than a handful of the very best things that caught my eye. If you'd like to receive that email, hop on my website at capitalallocatorspodcast.com and join the mailing list.